Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 344.
This week on the podcast, Joe Biden was accused of a Trump-worthy sexual assault, but you probably didn't hear about it.
Question, are we just going to end up with Andrew Cuomo as our president?
And America smashed records all week. We're number one in coronavirus cases and in unemployment. Beat that, China.
Plus, apparently we just had $2 trillion laying around the whole time.
And the latest on coronavirus, Trump is getting great ratings. That makes all the death and fear worth it, right?
And Trump finally invokes P on Twitter, whatever P is.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
That's right. Look at our faces.
That's right. If you are on YouTube right now and not listening to us on iTunes or I guess iTunes doesn't exist, on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on one of the many audio sources
Stitcher.
We distribute to, You can now see our beautiful faces on YouTube because we are doing a video recording of this podcast because we thought, hey, we're at home. We don't have anything better to
this
do.
This was how we recorded last week anyway, because we are recording into separate devices and Zoom is the way that we are sort of like having the conversation with each other, and then we were like, wait, you can just record that. So here we are.
I'm
recording into my phone, which is our method. We have a potentially weird method, but it also, I listened to a lot of podcasts this week, some that are like supposedly professional podcasts, where I literally like one I was listening to on my like nice sound system in my house that I have, and I literally was finding it interesting but could not listen to it on it. I had to listen to it on my phone with headphones because to be able to hear the guest, I had to have it cranked so loud that the host could be heard in like all 500 units in my apartment complex, basically.
This is a method that we learned thanks to the interview circuit that I did for the VCF renewal process last year, where I had to do a bunch of remote interviews for podcasts and other audio sources. And one of the reporters taught me that basically, if you have people record onto two separate devices and one is the one you're talking to them on and one is the one that you're actually recording on, you get clean audio and everyone's happier. And so that's what we're doing now. And
that's
I think it's working pretty well.
I know. And it's also just a good idea for us to do because it forced me to shower today.
That's right. Yeah,
it's great.
It's been an interesting opportunity to be potentially seen by other humans.
Oh, yeah. This is the best that I have looked in at least 10 days.
Right. This is the cleanest my clothes have been in at least
100%.
10 days.
Oh, so, and I wanted to wear, since we were recording, I wanted to wear my census button, hashtag will be counted. So everybody,
right, if you're listening
to
the audio
We've
version.
We've been telling you every week, but like, we'll tell you again, because you should still be doing it if you haven't.
Right.
So
do the census even more than you're already doing it, if possible. Do as much of the census as you can humanly do.
Yeah.
Do the census that much. And we are bringing breaking-ish news. It's not breaking news in the sense that you haven't already heard it because of Twitter and whatnot.
Right. But it just happened in our lives.
It just happened in our lives. The president is extending the national social distancing guidelines through April 30th. So I guess we are not getting the Easter reprieve that he hoped for.
The churches are not going to be packed on Easter.
What a shame. Yeah. What
but
a shame.
But we might be able to have a celebratory drink for my birthday.
That's right.
Which is that day. So
the obvious holiday that he was thinking of when he thought, what is right after Easter that's celebratory? And it was like, well, Brent's birthday is the next biggest day of the year. So
that is
when we'll be all coming out of our homes, apparently. Not in California, where we're probably doing this through the end of May. But in the rest of the country, where people are still enjoying their lives and going to various group activities, apparently.
Right. Or if you live in Brentwood and needed to go to the farmer's market today.
I mean, why are the farmer's markets still open? I get that food is an essential service, but like, good Lord, find another way to distribute it. I was shocked when they didn't close the farmer's markets like initially right off the bat. And I get that they sort of fell into this like food service, like essential items category, but they are not being conducted in a way where you can maintain
social
distance.
No, because even the grocery stores now are doing, you know, are letting very few people in. You have to wait in line because they're doing like one in, one out. Like they're the hottest club in town, basically. But you have to wait 6 feet away from people in lines. They have them like marked, like on the ground, like while you wait. And then when you get in there, you're like one of the only people that's in there because they're trying to...
Initially, they weren't doing that for the lines, too.
You're right. But you can't do that at a farmer's market. I mean, there were pictures from that Brentwood farmer's market today where, like, I mean, what looked like hundreds of people just sort of, like, roaming around shoulder to shoulder, like, buying food.
It looked like an everyday, regular farmer's market,
which is... And also, Brentwood is exactly fairly high up in L.A. County as far as coronavirus
cases.
Not only
is it fairly high up, but it is the number one purveyor of coronavirus in the entire county.
As of today.
Oh, it's not?
Melrose is taking
over. Melrose is taking the lead. Brent and I have been very carefully monitoring which neighborhoods are in the lead on the coronavirus count, largely because West Hollywood was leading at the beginning.
Right.
And we were just curious to see how long we'd stay.
A part of the city that I would have thought was West Hollywood anyway. Exactly. So, like, between West Hollywood, which is already the most per capita because they're counting more people in Melrose, in that district.
Number one.
So we're sort of in, like, you know, we're in the biggest hotspot of LA County, which isn't ideal. It's not what you're looking for.
It's not great. Well, I have some theories about why that is, actually. I was thinking about that today because I was chatting with my family on Zoom, and I was like, LA seems to be having a little bit of there seems to be like a coronavirus hotspot here in West Hollywood, and I think it probably started because of the gyms.
I think gyms and also, like, people were going to the bars for far too long, too.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is the place in the city, like, if you're going to... And not just, like, the gay bars, too, but also just on Sunset.
Right.
Like, that is being... That's counted as West Hollywood, too. So it's, like, I think that people were sort of, like, closely packed together the most here. I mean, it was probably, like... Nothing is close to New York City here, but just in terms of sort of, like, amount of people condensed into a place, like, I think those...
Right,
two
we're on
areas
the denser side here.
Are the probably the closest.
I agree. And also, Melrose has a huge Hasidic community, so there's a chance that that is also part of, you know, I mean, that's kind of what happened in New York. Those initial numbers were so high in New York because of New Rochelle, and that's a very insular community. And one person went to, like, a bar mitzvah and to shul and ended up infecting, like, hundreds of people. And so I think that's something that is a possibility for why this has taken off in Melrose.
Could be.
A neighborhood no one's heard of until now.
Right. Also, I'm drinking wine on this podcast. I don't know who you think I am, but just...
Brent drinks wine on the podcast all the time. I don't
I
know.
Do.
Also,
I know, but nobody sees me.
But you usually announce it.
Do I?
Yes.
Oh, well, I forget
because
I'm drunk.
You almost
always do. No, I'm just kidding. I'm not.
That's right. We thought we would
do
something...
It's 6 o'clock.
Yeah, whatever. It's wine time. You're allowed.
Yep.
We thought we would do something... a little bit unusual because we know that everyone is just, like, ODing on coronavirus news, and we are going to bring you political coronavirus news later in this podcast for sure, because that's most of the news that's out there. But we wanted to start with discussion about some campaign news, because that's probably news you're less likely to be reading and less likely to be discussing amongst yourselves. And there was a huge campaign story this week.
Yeah, it's also the story that's probably most likely to be intentionally being covered up.
Correct. Because there was a pretty serious and pretty credible sexual assault accusation made against Joe Biden this week. This was from one of his accusers from earlier. So there were, like, eight women that came forward a while ago saying that he had been inappropriate with them. But one of them came forward this week and said that she had actually been sexually assaulted by him in 1993. She was a former aide to him when he was in the Senate, and she was on Katie Halper's podcast and said that Biden, quote, kissed her and penetrated her with his fingers without her consent. And then she said she pushed Biden off of her, and he allegedly became annoyed and said, "Come on, man, I heard you liked me." And
which
then,
you can hear him saying, by the way. Say to yourself...
Right.
What
would
Joe Biden
say while
he
was sexually assaulting somebody?
Right. So that's
it. And then, so she tried to pull away, and he pointed in her face and said, "You're nothing to me." She said she had initially not come forward with this, I think, because she did not have witnesses and she was worried about how she would be treated by
the public. And she was also, but you mentioned, you know, she was one of the eight women who had already accused him
of inappropriate touching
before. And so, and she was received, a lot, like a whole onslaught of harassment at that point that sort of, like, quieted her from doing more, but she sort of felt like, you know, she now needed to.
Exactly. So the Biden campaign denied this through his deputy campaign manager, who said women have a right to tell their story and reporters have an obligation to rigorously vet those claims. We encourage them to do so because these accusations are false. But you also can immediately see why she didn't come forward, because, you know, last year after she was after she accused Biden of just inappropriate touching, she was called a Russian operative. They were dragging her own voting record through the mud. You know, she was a Warren supporter who switched to Bernie, and that is mentioned in every single story that's written on it. She had tried to approach Time's Up to help her come forward, but they wouldn't offer her help because Biden is a candidate for federal office and they're a 501c3, and so they were afraid they were going to lose their nonprofit status.
Yeah,
so
she was kind of left
to do it on her own, which is not a great look for anyone involved. And so it kind of, the story has grown a bit, but it kind of was like a slow burn. By the end of the week, there were some hashtags floating around on Twitter, our only place to communicate with each other these days, that were like things like hashtag I believe Tara, hashtag unendorsed Biden, hashtag Time's Up Biden. But we really haven't seen much in the way of a response from his camp beyond just that one denial from a surrogate. And we haven't really seen larger media really working to vet this story.
No. I think that he just thinks, and he may be right, which is sad, but I think that he just thinks that it's going to go away.
Yeah, I think he does too. And I have a new radicalized theory about this era in DC, because I was thinking about this a little bit. So I'm writing a book about my sort of 18-year 9/11 health, you know, advocacy work. And in that book, I have a sort of mention of what was going on in our lives just before 9/11. And one of the things that I was thinking about was Chandra Levy, that former intern, I think she was with the Federal Bureau of Prisons or something, who disappeared. And was like, it was like a huge scandal. She was having an affair with a congressman at the time, and they think he killed her. And it was like a whole thing. And it was like all we talked about for like a year. And it was, you know, it was sort of buried by September 11th, basically. So we were still speculating about it up until like that August, basically. And then, you know, September 11th happened. But I had been thinking about the sort of larger scope of what kind of messaging women were getting about where their role in politics was in that era. Because we're talking about an era where women had to watch the, you know, Joe Biden and others questioning of Anita Hill. We're talking about the Monica Lewinsky era. And then we're talking about an era that sort of bookended by like a Chandra Levy type. These are all, you know, like successful and or sort of like well-connected women who had their lives almost destroyed by men in Washington.
Totally.
And I was just thinking about like as someone who grew up in that era, as someone who, you know, for whom that era was like a formative time in my political sort of, growth, like the idea that I spent 10 years just constantly hammered with messages about not just that politics was not a place for women, but that that Washington was a physically unsafe place to be a woman is sort of mind-blowing to me now. Sure. I'm sort of like of the mind now that we basically shouldn't let anyone from that era be the president. Like, I think if you were in office between 1991 and 2001, like, I think maybe we should just eliminate you. Because you were complicit in this behavior that basically told an entire generation of women that they were not welcome and that Washington was not for them, not because they couldn't, you know, not because they didn't have the right ideas, not even for the traditional reasons that we exclude women, but because it was going to be physically unsafe for them to be there. Like,
totally.
Their lives would be destroyed.
I mean, you've certainly, that it is radical in the sense that it, you know, takes it a step further in saying that you don't think that anybody should be president from that era. But, you know, we have seen, you know, people, you know, I'm thinking of Kirsten Gillibrand right now, who sort of like got into some hot water for things that she has said about Bill Clinton, because she's obviously sort of like, you know, at the forefront of, you know, women's issues in politics these days. And so, you know, I don't think that that is actually so far out of the mainstream, really, because I think that other people have certainly thought it.
Yeah,
I think probably.
I mean, in the sense that that together.
No, but I and I don't know that. You're absolutely right. Like,
I get that that excludes Bernie Sanders too. I get that that excludes a lot of people who I don't think personally have probably done anything wrong, and you know, who I think themselves seek to make the moral choice whenever possible. But that whole the way that government functioned for that whole era was destructive, and I feel like maybe we should just be like, this is the end of that. Like, we're starting with new people now.
Totally.
Like, you guys did it wrong. The 90s, for some reason, and I know there's been harassment in Washington this whole time. I'm not suggesting that it has been either solved or that it wasn't much worse before that.
Yeah,
but
of course.
For some reason, there was just, like, a 10-year blip where, like, when we reflect on it, some very extreme kinds of violence against women were perpetrated. Because I think when you think about what happened to Monica Lewinsky, that was really a violence that was committed against her. It ruined her whole life, you know? And totally. And she was, when you think now about the way in which she was blamed for that and destroyed over that, even though, you know, she was like this very young woman and the president was really who was responsible. Like, and when you, right. you know, when you think about how Anita Hill's career got derailed by an accusation that she made against someone who had harassed her, when you think about right. the fact that Chandra Levy ended up dead, like, I mean, that there was just an era of bad seatedness. And this yeah. claim from Tara Reid against Joe Biden is from that era. And that's, I think, why it made me think of it, because it is entirely believable to me that a man of Joe Biden's stature would think that was an appropriate thing to do in that era, because look at what the president was doing.
Sure.
I mean, look at what people were doing to women all, and what even he himself was helping do to Anita Hill. But like, look at what all of these men were doing to all of these women in Washington in that era. So I feel like, let's give up on them.
I'm in.
I'm over it. It's enough. Yeah. And listen, I get that that means that Bernie Sanders can't be the president, but Liz Warren could still be the president. Sure. She wasn't in Washington at that time. So we still have somebody. I just like can't anymore with any of it.
Well, I do think that this is probably one of the last elections that we'll have to worry about it anyway.
Yeah, that's fair.
But
I hope. Right? I mean, but I mean, I thought,
I guess that wasn't really,
I thought
that
we were
ago.
Over that already.
Yeah, I know.
I thought that we had already gone over that hump. So
right. I know.
I don't know what I think anymore.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, despite the fact that these accusations have come up, Biden is inclined to not be willing to not agree to debate Bernie Sanders again.
No, there's been enough. There's been enough, it's enough debates, debate. Guys.
Just because there's new
while
information.
I tend to agree with him broadly. There's only been one between the two of them, which I think is what's important. I think taken in totality, there were far too many. Yes, agreed.
Yeah. Well, and also, I mean, we're talking about an evolving situation. I think the other thing is, like, there have been too many debates. No one would argue with that. But there have not been too many debates about this new era that we're living in.
There haven't. And I think that it's also important. So many of these states now are going to be voting with a different mindset when they go to vote. And also, so many states still haven't voted because, like, basically all of the primaries toward the end of March and anywhere through April have been mostly rescheduled, and the ones that haven't, everybody seems to think that they probably will reschedule them. So I think it's also just important to have this conversation one last time before people do vote. And I'm not saying that it'll change anything, but I mean, like, I think, especially considering, you know, Biden's like gaffe fest of this week, which we're going to get to next.
Oh,
I mean, I think that it's probably important to, you know, he did okay in the last debate in the sense that he was sort of like present for 2 hours, which actually was sort of surprising to me.
Yeah.
I think it would be a good idea to see if he can do it again.
Yeah. I think we, given how many times he hasn't seemed present for debates, it seems like we might want to not rely on just one debate, just in case that was an anomaly.
Yeah. And also, you know, this was a debate that was on the schedule. I mean, it doesn't have a specific day yet, but there was an initial debate schedule had included an April debate, like that the DNC put out, like their official debate schedule. They don't have a date set, and they don't have a venue, they don't have a media partner or anything like that. But I mean, like, this is not like a new thing that, like, you know, Sanders did say earlier this week that he would commit to it, which was why Biden was asked and said that he didn't want to. But it's not, Bernie Sanders didn't make up a new debate. I mean, this was a debate that was scheduled. And the contest certainly isn't over with yet. And there have been new developments. So, like, to say that you're just not going to do it, I don't think that that is going to be, like, a super great idea for him, especially if we sort of see similar things from him over the course of the next, you know, 2 to 3 weeks.
Well, that's, I mean, he's had a chance to really curate his media appearances lately, and he has not successfully sounded coherent in them still.
I mean, last week we were like on his case for having disappeared, and I think we saw this week why he had disappeared.
Yeah.
I mean, perhaps the party would be better if he remained disappeared. Because he certainly didn't do himself any favors on television this week.
He never does. This is an environment that he's really poorly suited to. Like, this political environment that we're in right now is one he's really poorly suited to, because he is somebody who I think is probably well-liked on the Hill. He's somebody who has good relationships on the Hill. Having to campaign in a vacuum where his only relationship can be with the American people is not what he's there to do.
No.
He's there to parade a bunch of endorsees around and be like, see, all these people love me.
Exactly.
And if he can't do that because they're not allowed to be in the same room as him, then I don't know what is he, you know, then we get the kind of interviews that we're getting from him right now on cable news, which are like,
I know,
lunatic-y interviews.
Yeah. Well, let's just give you sort of like the rundown of his week. I mean, we're talking about it, so let's tell you. I mean, you may have seen some of them, but like, we started the week off, you know, finally got Wi-Fi set up at his home.
Right.
We're
there.
The Leafs got there. Right. So that first teleconference thing that he did. Oh, he's also installed a podium at his house whatever reason.
That was the most confounding part of all of this is I was like, okay, you're setting up a home studio to look presidential. Fine. Yeah. But like, you are at your home and we all know you're at your home. Why did they bring a podium in? What kind of, like, how unrelatable is that?
I know.
When you, and, like, are we right now speaking to you at a podium just because we have the internet on, video on in our house? Like, what?
I know. He looked, it did not instill confidence in anyone. He looked very tired, very low energy, and he was also, like, had a total mishap, like, as he does every time that he is on some sort of, like, thing that involves technology, basically. Because
it's like him, it's like asking your grandfather to...
Right. It appeared as though his teleprompter went out, or whatever he was reading from disappeared, because he was attempting to detail his plan to fight coronavirus, which you would think he may know, at least partially from memory. But he appeared to lose track of where he was on the teleprompter, or it went off or whatever. And you could see him sort of like waving at his staff member to like give him something. And then he's stumbling through, and he like tries to ad lib, and he just goes through this whole uncomfortable ad lib. And then he was like, and then he finishes it with saying, well, I guess I've just spoken enough on that. And then he like moved on. So that was that. No teleprompter working, ad libbed incoherency.
Then he went on The View. That was...
Should have been friendly company at The View.
That's right. Sarah Haynes asked if businesses should reopen in the near future, and his response was, we have to take care of the cure, and we'll make the problem worse. That will make the problem worse no matter what.
Huh? Everyone was confused.
It's not a sense.
Most of all, clearly Joe Biden was the most confused out of everyone.
Exactly.
But the answer left everyone confused.
Yeah, that's right.
And then later in the day, he was on CNN with Jake Tapper and started the interview almost immediately with like having a coughing fit, which just isn't
do you think
great
I have,
in this time.
How many times
I mean, like,
have you wondered this last couple weeks if the reason he's in a bunker is because he has coronavirus? Because I have been very worried about that, because I would think that as a man who is 78 and in a world where we're all worried about old people dying of a terrible illness, that the one confidence he might want to instill in us is that he is not currently dying of that illness.
Right.
Like,
but the big issue on that interview, though, was when he did it, is he like hacked all over his hand.
Right.
And so Jake Tapper was like, sir, you're supposed to cough into your elbow. And then, like, there was, like, this whole discussion of Jake Tapper lecturing Joe Biden on how you're supposed to be coughing these days.
Like,
he's also, like, the world's leading face toucher.
I mean, of course he is.
Like, there's a lot of supercuts of his Tuesday appearances online that you can see that would be hilarious if it wasn't so deeply upsetting. I mean, nobody touches their face more. He has not gotten the memo, or did and hasn't been able to control it, but...
I even remember during the last debate when we were already trying to be social distancing and he had to stand awkwardly far from Bernie Sanders at those six-foot-apart podiums or whatever.
Yeah.
After the debate was over, he went and, like, spoke to the moderators within two or 3 feet of them. And Bernie Sanders kind of was like, ooh,
I'm out.
My mic. He kind of walked away like this deuces. And was just sort of like, bye. Because he was respecting
social distancing protocol.
But Joe Biden, like, can't... You know in your heart that Joe Biden is someone who can't social distance.
No.
Eight women have told us that.
Based on our previous story, we know that he can't.
Exactly. So it's sad situation for him himself, for him personally to find himself in. And then he was also on Nicole Wallace on MSNBC. Lost his train of thought completely. Wallace asked him to go ahead and finish his point, and he said, "Oh, it's probably best that I don't."
Yeah, but when you couple that with the sexual assault allegation, which granted hasn't been getting much play, it has it's not been a great week for Joe Biden, which has led to some interesting things that sort of started on what were probably the dark web, but are sort of inching their way into borderline mainstream media.
The light web. Right. Well, I also feel like this is not just something that's coming from the dark web, because it's also coming from the left, oddly. I'm hearing it everywhere from people who are not reading Drudge. You know, who are not taking it, getting it 100%. From those sources.
Well, there's an article in the Boston Globe about it, which I think was sort of like when I first was kind of like, is that there is sort of like there's a draft Andrew Cuomo situation going on right now.
And what's been really interesting, because obviously I'm in touch with a lot of people in New York, as I would be as a person who's from New York and involved in an issue that is largely focused on New York. I'm hearing this a lot from New Yorkers who are all people who hate him. People in New York City hate Andrew Cuomo because he hates Bill de Blasio, and the two of them are having, like, they hate both of them, but they've been having a pissing match for years that has led to some hilarious problems. Like
a large one right now.
Well, and they once had a fight about whether to save a deer that had swum across the Hudson River. Like, I mean, there's been some hilarious versions of this fight, too. Like, a deer swam across the Hudson and ended up in the Bronx, and there was a fight over whether to save or kill the deer. And they came in on different sides of that. Like, that's the kind of stuff that we've been dealing with now in New York for a while. But I they're in another one now because de Blasio has been much more hesitant to exercise what I would say is effective and good leadership on the coronavirus front. And Andrew Cuomo has been pretty good on this issue and has been trying to encourage de Blasio to be better by being an asshole to him.
I've texted you multiple times during those Cuomo press conferences, because, you know, you obviously sort of have more experience with Andrew Cuomo, but I, you know, obviously we've been doing this podcast for 8 years, so I am familiar with enough with Andrew Cuomo, and also sort of like, you know, I'm not like the world's biggest fan. I don't have any sort of like personal animosity to him. Like, what? Right.
No, but he's an asshole politician.
Like, they are very, those press conferences are very comforting. Like, in a way that I sort of, like, wasn't really expecting, and I sort of, like, happened on accidentally, ultimately, just because I have CNN on while I'm working from home. But, you know, they're comforting in, they sort of really make you pine for that type of leadership, where it's sort of like, I've been thinking to myself this week, where it's sort of like, there's something about, like, somebody who is just good at politics, like, in this time, like, is actually sort of comforting. He's not just competent, but like also every single one of those press conferences has, you know, the one the other day, he sort of like talked about, you know, the conversations that he's been able to have with his daughters who are home, and like the stories that he's getting from his friends who are like finishing books and things like that. And like, sure, those are just, they're anecdotal. It's, you know, political theater, at least to a degree anyway, but like, those are the types of things that when you are struggling at home by yourself to sort of like latch on to something good in the world, that having somebody actually give that to you instead of just bloviating for a few minutes and then having an endless parade of people coming up and telling you how great you are, which is what the Trump press
president
conferences
is doing.
And talking about his television ratings, which he did today. You know, I mean, so I get it. I mean, like, there's... Especially now.
Well, and this is one thing I think that we have said before on the podcast, but is worth thinking about now in relation to this story, which is Cuomo is someone with bad political instincts in the sense that he has the same bullshit, moderate Democratic political instincts that a lot of politicians you hate in the world have. But he has always been someone who can take a note. And so he can
learn. He's good at the game, which is sort of almost like what you need right now. I mean, you need somebody competent, which he seems to be mostly.
How to exercise effective leadership. He does. His father was a great.
Right, he probably read a book about it.
No, his father was a great governor. He grew up with a father who was actually a good governor, and who should have ended up on the Supreme Court. And, you know, I think New Yorkers do remember his father very fondly. And so I think he does have a sort of role model for how to be an effective and competent and high quality leader. And I think he's just sort of tapping into that right now.
Yeah.
But he's somebody who can learn. That's what I think. What we're seeing with Donald Trump is that he's not someone who can learn. So even when you think you've taught him something, he kind of, it filters out of his brain eventually. And then he kind of goes back to being terrible. And Cuomo is somebody who, even if he would not be the kind of president that you and I would excitedly want, or, you know, excitedly vote for, he would be the kind of person who lacks vision. But he's someone who, if the chips were down and it looked like, listen, we got to get single-payer healthcare passed, he would suddenly be in favor of it.
I remember that after 2016. I mean, he sort of like tacked to the left, you know? He sort of like latched on to free college. I mean, it was ultimately sort of like Hillary Clinton's plan. You know, it was sort of like, you know, there were rules about like who could go to college for free. But I mean, you know, I mean, he saw the political wins in a way where he was at least just sort of like, okay, well, like, here's what I'm comfortable doing
that is going to like make the
most amount of people happy.
Yeah. He's always been really good at reading those. And that, I think, would be very useful right now, in part because that's why he's managed to find a role for himself as an effective leader on this issue, is because he's listening to experts. And when he is wrong, he is learning that he's wrong and he's changing his mind.
Yeah.
And you kind of want that right now.
Yeah. But there were articles in the Boston Globe about like what sort of like steps would have to happen for this to actually go down if like he were to become the nominee. There was an article in the Washington Times, which is borderline New York Post borderline, but I Tucker Carlson is out there talking about it. So I also sort of like am not delusional in the sense that like some of these Twitter accounts could have been planted by bots or Russia or, you know, GOP, who are just trying to sow discontent. This is what they do. They've done it before. They have claimed that they will do it again. So I can, I can, you know, like I'm not going to say it's not that, but also after this week, it seemed to sort of, and I think that's why people were writing about it, you know, after Tuesday, which was the last day of the, you know, the Biden disaster, that I think that people are potentially looking for something that they feel a little bit more comfortable with. And also there was a poll that came out from ABC News, I think it was just today or yesterday, that was, I think, disconcerting to a lot of people, that basically had, well, it had Biden and Trump tied, but then what was, I think, the most troubling part, and I think that we all could have seen this writing on the wall, and I think this was why it was never a good idea to roll with, you know, ride with Biden, go riding with Biden.
Well, it's never a good idea to draft a candidate, essentially,
because that's what he ended up doing. Because this is how you lose. But in this poll, it said 55% of registered voters who already support Donald Trump say they are very enthusiastic about that support. That actually seems almost surprisingly low for me for him, because if you're a Trump supporter, then it seems like that number would be higher.
Who's a little into Trump?
Right. But the same, when asked about Joe Biden, of people who already support him, 24% say they are very enthusiastic.
Yeah, well, what's to be enthusiastic about?
To be enthusiastic
about? All there is to be enthusiastic about is that he's not Donald Trump. If you would ask those same people if they were enthusiastic to vote for someone besides Donald Trump, they would have said yes. 100% of them would have been excited, enthusiastic to vote for someone who wasn't Donald Trump, basically.
Totally.
But this is how we lose.
It's how we lose.
That's a textbook losing strategy.
Totally.
We know it because we've tried it four times before. I know people wanted to, you know, people want to compare Hillary Clinton. And I would say that there was much more enthusiasm for her than there is for him right now.
Totally.
Much more. I respect that we weren't enthusiastic about her, but I also am a person with eyes and ears who knew that there were some very enthused, I would say about half the electorate was very excited to vote for her.
Yeah, for sure.
And so she's not the only person to compare this to. But let's talk about Al Gore. Let's talk about John Kerry. I mean, these are, what we're following is a long textbook, not just a short textbook strategy, but like a long-term strategy the DNC has pursued to lose elections. Because I would like to remind you that none of those people became the president. The only one who became the president was a guy who robbed Hillary Clinton of her ordained time to run. That's the guy that became the president. So this is not a winning coalition of voters.
It is not.
It's concerning, you know?
Quite.
So meanwhile, the federal government acted the quickest they've ever acted on anything this week, even though it took them 5 days longer than it should have.
Wild.
After, you know, we talked a little bit, I think, last week about the Senate bill that McConnell wrote behind the Democrats' back to put forward to force them to vote against a terrible bill that was sounded like it was going to be, you know, funding for people and was instead just corporate bailouts. This week, the House, the Senate, and the President all passed a bill that has now been signed into law that is a $2 trillion economic relief plan. So apparently, we don't have to ask how we're paying for things anymore. No. So that's fun. Bernie Sanders gave a great viral speech about the about an initial GOP holdup, because there was one holdup that had to do with the unemployment benefits this bill provides, where there are certain cases with very low wage workers where these enhanced unemployment benefits this bill provides might pay them slightly more than they actually make in their real jobs. And Bernie Sanders was like, oh, so we're going to sit here and be concerned that a bunch of people who make less than $15 an hour might make just slightly more than they normally make, but we're also going to, we also can't restrict any of the money going to billionaires. Like, we're just going to sit and gripe because poor people deserve to stay poor and we shouldn't do anything to help them, but we're going to give all this money free and clear to the rich, no big deal. It was a great speech. I recommend you look it up. AOC also gave a great speech about the corporate bailout money that's in this bill, but we're going to tell you a little bit about, you've probably heard about the $1,200 stimulus checks that are going to go to people who make, you know, under $75,000, and then the smaller ones that will go to people who make between $75,000 and $99,000 a year.
Yeah.
What you probably know less about is what else is in the bill, because it's a huge bill. Right. So we're going to talk a little
bit. Because you stopped reading after you found out that you were going to get a $1,200 check from the government.
That's right. So we're going to tell you a little bit about what's in the rest of the bill that you might be interested in. You probably know that there's enhanced unemployment benefits. The federal government's going to kick in $600 a week for up to 4 months.
Right. That's what you were just mentioning that Sanders was so mad about, because this is what the GOP was trying to hold up. And just a point about that also, like, think of the fact that, like, giving them $600 a week would allow them to make more than they were making. Think about whether they are maybe just not making enough anyway. That's where your brain should go. It should not be that they're getting a raise. It should be that they need a fucking raise.
That's right. That's the part of it to think about. Yeah. Needless to say, the GOP senators still tried to block it on Wednesday over that measure. Lindsey Graham said it would rob people of the desire to work.
Oh, yeah.
But so, in any case, unemployment numbers have skyrocketed to a degree that is actually, like, pretty hard to comprehend using head math. And so it is actually critically important that enhanced unemployment benefits come through, because the number of people that filed unemployment claims last week was 3.28 million.
Yeah. Economists that had been surveyed going into last week thought that it was going to be 1.5 million. So they more than doubled that. Yikes. And that, like, the previous record was 665,000.
Yeah, that was from March of 2009.
Or no, that was the last big number. The all-time previously was in 1982, which was 695,000. Yeah. So we've never come anywhere near this.
Shot right over those numbers.
Anywhere near this. But don't worry, guys, it's fine, because Steve Mnuchin said that they were not relevant.
I'll tell you why they're not relevant, because they're not relevant. They're not relevant because the number of people... That is the number of people who were able to file claims, not the number of people who are out of work.
You know,
I don't qualify for unemployment claims because I'm an independent contractor. So under this stimulus bill, I might. It's not clear yet. But
more people are going to be filing, too. I mean, if we're social distancing until April 30th, then, like, we're going to be continually laying people off and continually closing places.
But
like,
this 3.28 million number already doesn't include people who don't qualify for unemployment because they did not make enough to pay into the system to get, you know, to get out of it. It doesn't include anyone who was already out of work. It doesn't include any independent contractors who lost business or lost clients and are unable to make their bills because of that. So the actual unemployment figures are much, much higher.
Right, exactly. I do think
that sense, it's not relevant.
You're right about the numbers. I think one of the good things about the bill is
it does expand who
qualifies for unemployment. That doesn't have anything to do with the numbers. You're right. They're obviously higher than 3.28 million. Yeah. But some of those people that you just listed are going to get help, which is good.
But those people would not have been in that 3.28 million pool at all.
Right.
Those people are newly entering the unemployment world. Right. But anyway, back to the bill. There's also a $500 billion corporate slush fund to be divvied up to industries like the airlines, maybe some to cities and states. The rules are that the bill, the rules in the bill are that an inspector general and an accountability committee have to oversee how the money is spent, but those will be appointed by the Trump administration. Right. So,
and he's already figuring out ways around this. I feel like he's already tweeted something that like is going to be able to sort of either get rid of this or just make that part go away, probably.
So that's a sixth of the bill is going to an unregulated corporate giveaway.
Right. And that has been a big, well, that's, as you mentioned, that's what AOC was railing on about. But this has been sort of like, and that there wasn't initially any accountability in it. And this is one of the things that was sort of holding it up on the Senate side, because they were trying to make sure that that got put in there, because they just didn't want to just give, just throw $500 billion out into the world. You know, for some of these corporations, we've seen what happens when we do that before.
Corporate buybacks.
Yeah, exactly.
They just buy their own stock back and then they pay their executives millions of dollars.
Right. And continue just laying everybody off.
Yeah. So there's an $100 billion grant to hospitals and healthcare providers to help them deal with coronaviruses. And also one thing that I think this raises is hospitals are losing huge amounts of money because they focus on elective surgeries a lot of the time because those are the cash cows. Hospitals operate like for-profit entities in this country. And that is, they're not designed to serve the best or the most important health needs of the society because they have to function in a way that makes a profit. So hospitals are going broke right now. And this is not a time to be losing hospitals, but they're going broke right now because they're having to delay all their cash cow surgeries and focus on coronavirus treatment. So the federal government is giving them grants to help make up for some of that loss, but I don't think it's going to be enough. They're probably going to have to give them more. And then also they're getting a 20% bump in Medicare payments for patients with the virus. But one of the reasons we're in the crisis that we're in terms of having the fewest hospital beds of any developed nation on earth per capita and having, you know, hospitals that are kind of poorly equipped to take on this level of crisis is because our hospital system is designed to function for a profit. It's not designed to serve the health needs of our society.
Right.
Something to think about for the future. In any case, $58 billion to airlines. Some of its grants, some of its loans.
Right.
That they did get some regulation on. They're not allowed to do stock buybacks because that's what they did last time. We gave them a lot of money.
Yep.
And there are limits on executive compensation. And half the funds have to go towards the continuation of paying employees salaries and benefits and things like that. But
right.
In any case, they're getting a bailout.
They are. Yes.
There's
also incentives for retaining payroll. So basically
other businesses
are going to get a tax credit for keeping idled workers on their payrolls. So as long as the businesses like meet certain criteria, they're going to get a refund of half of what they spend on wages up to $5,000 per worker. So basically just like incentives to keep paying people.
Exactly. There's some, but not nearly enough money for state and local governments because they're obviously just like hemorrhaging money because they're having to put up all the funds to deal with this crisis because the federal government's been so slow to react.
Cuomo was really on top of this morning, which was
and went
sort of
off
like
on Schumer,
delicious,
which is just
sort
amazing.
Of like was asked, like said that Chuck Schumer should worry about passing a bill that like benefits his state, basically, and like. And then was like talking about sort of like because New York is supposed to be doing a budget next week, and he was like, "We're having a anywhere between a $10 and $15 billion hole in our budget, and like I have to create a budget, and I can't assume that it's ever going to come to us," because he said something to the effect of like, if the federal government was going to have sent us that money, then they would have done it already, and like I mean was really just like ragging on.
It's good for him.
I mean, anybody, basically.
Yeah.
Pelosi has said that, like, they're going to come back and this is going to be a thing that they are going to revisit. But, like, states need that money now. Like, that's not just sort of, like, we'll get it to you when we can. I mean, like, they're spending it. And they have to figure out how to spend moving forward. This thing isn't going away. So, like, that is something that there should have been more money in there for, as opposed to, like, worry about state governments before you worry about how much you're giving the airline industry,
right?
For God's sake. Like, keep New York alive.
It
just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. It's so curious the way that this money this money shows where the priorities of the government lie. there was some money in there for the DOD because we're having to deploy the National Guard and a bunch of on-call soldiers to help with state responses. And it also would include $415 million on research and development work for the Pentagon to related to vaccines and antiviral treatments and things like that. I've been really surprised, and this is, I think, largely because Trump doesn't know what's going on most of the time, but, like, this is actually what the military is good for. Like, totally. I know we're not trying to have the military out there fighting unnecessary wars, but, like, the military has a really important skill set in a moment
and,
like this.
Yeah,
this
and is we've a national kind security of seen issue. It. We're starting to see it a little bit.
We're starting to finally see it a little bit, but they weren't being given the funding to actually do the work they need to do. Right. And they really do have expertise with logistics and crisis
setting
management.
Setting up hospitals.
And setting, setting up field hospitals. I mean, they have a lot of the expertise that we need in a moment like this. And they weren't being called upon, which was nuts. And then protections for insurers from price gouging on the coronavirus test. We're hearing a lot. Insurers wanted an emergency fund to offset their losses. And there was an article today in the New York Times about how they're going to pump up their premiums by like 40% next year to offset this. I want to remind you of one thing, which is because they were mad because they didn't get more bailout funding in this bill. And I'm sure they'll get some eventually because
I'm sure.
Look who's in office. They did get this one thing protecting them from hospitals price gouging them on the coronavirus test or providers in general. But big insurers are saving a ton of money right now because we have canceled every other expensive elective procedure that was scheduled to be done from now until the end of time. and they got a $16 billion gift when Congress repealed the health insurance fee in December, the Obamacare health insurance fee. The ACA required them to pay partly into their payment structure. And so they have been gifted billions of dollars already this year. So they can fuck off. I'm very worried about them raising their rates because they're very cynical. So even if they don't need to, they will.
They're going to. And they're 100% going to.
This is going to create a second
You're
going to
be looking
crisis.
At like bronze plans next year that are like, going to probably cost you $10,000 before the year's over with.
Exactly. But just know that we don't actually have to allow that. Right. That is a choice that we're making to allow that. That's not something we have to allow. The losses that they're claiming are coming just as their stocks are rising rapidly because people are expecting them to make out big on this deal. They're expecting them to get a bailout. And also, they are literally an emergency insurance provider. That is, their job is to account for an unforeseen emergency. That's what their whole business is. Right. We don't need them if we're just going to have to account for it for them. And therefore, they don't accept any of the risk. The idea is that they accept the risk of insuring everybody in case there is a crisis like this. So this is bad business on their part if we, if they go broke. And we don't actually need them. This is work the government can do instead for not a profit. So if they need to go broke, we should let them, and we should pick up the slack. We 100%. Should not think that we have to be,
Blue
should be
Cross
blackmailing
is about
us.
To go under, don't give them unseen billions of dollars.
No, just, and especially like Blue Cross
just
is one
do
of
their
the
job
only,
for them.
It's one of the only nonprofit insurers of those. If fucking Aetna is about to go under, tell them to fuck all the way off.
Yeah.
I mean, at least Blue Cross is nonprofit. They're terrible. I mean, I'm not suggesting
they're not terrible. Right.
But I mean, we're talking about for-profit companies whose job it is to plan for risk. So sorry, this is literally the business you're in. If you are an insurance provider who suddenly is giving flood insurance and then suddenly there's a flood, your job is to pay out to that flood insurance. You were supposed to plan for that.
Yeah.
So don't let them fuck with you. we will. We're going to let them fuck with us. I'm going to be dead in a gutter next year, and it's just going to be because I couldn't afford a premium for health insurance because of this. Like, that is what this ends with. It doesn't end with us doing anything, because think about who's in charge. Think about the government right now and who's serving us. It's people who are in the pocket, of these people. And because of that, they're going to be slow to react, and people are literally going to die because of it. I mean, it's not going to be acceptable. In any case, back to the list. They are deferring Social Security taxes for employers and self-employed people, because self-employed people and employers themselves pay a 6.2% tax on their wages.
There's $200 million in there for like for telemedicine, like boosting Skype-type healthcare. So that's good.
Because that's how we're all getting our medicine healthcare. From now until the end of time.
Yeah.
They are reinstating a tax benefit that was kind of like a glitch in the tax code in 2017 that ended up retailers and restaurateurs and hotels were supposed to get to be able to deduct what they spent on capital improvements. And that ended up not working out. So they ended up in 2017 getting a worse deal than, you know, so that they fixed that. That's an unimportant one, but I'm just, it's important, I guess, if you're a retailer, it's not important to us. $10 billion for the Postal Service. The Democrats wanted $25 billion to keep them going. And then, language that would wipe out, they have an $11 billion debt.
Yep.
They are a critical public service at a time like this. So you would think that maybe if we're giving bailouts to large industries, we could bail out our public postal service. But here we are. There's $25 billion for SNAP.
Yeah, which is not what Democrats wanted to be able to get a 15% increase to SNAP, but they
like didn't. For households?
They didn't get it. Yeah.
But they know they're going to probably need to put more money into this coming forward, or moving forward, because no one has any fucking clue. Why not do it now? In the bill where you made up $2 trillion, why not make up $3 trillion? Like, I don't understand why, once we're playing with fake money,
go
for it.
Right?
You know? What's the point? There's $24 billion for farmers and ranchers, including $14 billion for an obscure Depression-era financial institution that can stabilize the farm economy, that has discretion to stabilize the farm economy, and then emergency aid also. There's $30 billion for schools, for emergency education funding, for local schools and colleges as well. And then an exemption from excise taxes on alcohol for distilleries that are making hand sanitizer, because that's like a big thing right now is a ton of distilleries are producing hand sanitizer.
Yep.
And so they're exempting them from an excise tax on on alcohol for that.
Yeah.
Here's what's not
important to. Oh, I was just before we move on really quickly. It's important to mention, because you were just talking about making up money. Because this is not the first of these bills. You know, they've made up other trillions of dollars just in the last couple weeks in bailouts to various people. They have exceeded the amount of money they would need to make up to have universal health care, by the way, to have Medicare for all. Like the cost that Joe Biden keeps talking about. How are you going to pay for it? We have just apparently figured out how to pay for it.
We know how to pay for it.
We are not going to figure out how to pay for it. We're just, you know.
No, we all subscribe to modern monetary theory now, so it's fine.
Yeah.
It turns out that radical leftist idea is
important to remember. If you're wondering how we pay for Medicare for all,
don't.
We just figured it out.
Right. So it turns out we can.
So we have an answer now.
It's fine. And if we paid for Medicare for all, a lot of the costs in this bill would not be necessary, but we would also be saving money individually. Like, you individually would be in a better financial position right now.
Correct.
So think about all the fun that would be entailed with that. Right. Here's what's not in the bill. The Democrats wanted $2 billion to go to the FCC subsidy program that helps schools and libraries connect to the internet, because there is an issue right now where, because everyone is doing distance learning, kids who don't have access to the internet are at an enormous disadvantage. And so they wanted to put money into helping make sure that kids have access to the internet.
Yeah.
There is no money for the oil stash Trump wanted. So that's good. He was going to get that in this is a mystery.
Yep.
And there's also, interestingly, no relief for the cruise industry. Who pissed off who?
I think I mentioned it on the podcast last week. And I know that I am not the first person to say this, but I want to reiterate it again. And this makes me think even more that this is the case. I think that one of the things that we will not do in a post-coronavirus universe is go on cruises.
Yeah. Why would we?
The world is going to look different after this.
Yeah.
Cruises are disgusting cesspools.
Right.
Some of the most dramatic
early... People are getting norovirus all the time.
They're always getting sick. There's always horror stories from cruises. And we saw that happen on that one, what was the Grand Princess or whatever, that like came into San Francisco, that they had to figure out how to get people off of because there were coronavirus concerns on that. I mean, it's disgusting. And it should go away. And don't be going on cruises. It's gross. It's like actually gross.
Take to the sea if you'd like.
Sure.
But as a form of transportation and on a short jaunt to get the wind in your hair.
Yeah, that's right.
Do yeah. a smaller boat.
Smaller boats. We yeah, have bad for the other environment size boats. Also.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, that's
One interesting thing that I feel like a lot of people have been talking about this week because, you know, Congress has been continuing to meet and the House had to go back to vote on this. And
some of them have coronavirus.
Right. Some of them have coronavirus.
And some of them can't get tested for coronavirus. And so they don't know if they have right. coronavirus.
And all of them are in their early hundreds.
That's right.
So it's not great there. So there has been a lot of talk this week about why Congress has to be there. And there are a million different reasons, and some of them are kind of hilarious as to why Congress actually yep. has to be there. And this has been an ongoing thing that sort of like various people have tried to figure out over the years, specifically since 9/11. There have been disaster planners who have been trying to, you know, warn Washington of the risks of like a government that basically has you stuff everybody's most important people all in one place. And coronavirus is sort of like bringing that discussion back. So especially, like we said, the average age in the House is 58. In the Senate, it's nearly 63. Some of, like, the leadership is older than that. Some of them are in their 80s. So they're, like, and people have it. So it's, like, right. they should not be there. But as it turns out, it's not as easy as just sort of, like, deciding that they're going to work from home.
No.
So there's a few things that are holding it back. One, the leadership just isn't interested. Like, they don't care. They right. literally are like, this is not something that we're going to deal with. Like, it's not happening. So that's, for starters, just...
Well, that's a big...
That's a big one. That's a big hold-up. That's no recipe to get anything done. But it's also just, like, not remote voting they'd have to do. Like, I mean, they literally do everything in groups. That's sort of what... Yeah. That's what Congress means, actually. Right. right? You know? So, like,
to be debating... In Congress is to be with people.
Debating, marking up bills would be, like, completely impossible. And also, there's just some sort of, like, safety in terms of, like, documents. Like, how... If people are working from their kitchens, like, how do we get them, like, safe and secure documents?
Well, this has really been an issue for a lot of federal employees because, you know, I have a lot of friends who live in D.C. who work for the federal government or work, you know, in and around people who work for the federal government, and they were very slow to get work from home orders in a lot of those offices, and many of them have not gotten work from home orders because there is no way for them to review classified information outside of their offices.
Totally.
And that feels like something that maybe is worth figuring out for rank and file government employees in this environment, because many of them are going to get sick just because we haven't figured out how to set up a secure document system.
Right, exactly.
Like, people shouldn't have to die for secure documents.
Right, and that technical system is sort of like the next major main sticking point, yeah, actually. Well, because besides
being able... Think about every government...
Right, besides whether they can share sort of classified information with somebody in their kitchen, they're also just not going to be able to sort of like conduct government business on Zoom. Like, they're not going to be able to sort of like just use an off-the-shelf system. Yeah. So basically what they would have to do is to create an entirely new, you know, virtual like technology, basically, where all of them could do this. And their track record of building massive like one-off tech systems is checkered at best. So that's a problem. Like, there have been ideas that have been floated over the years that would like take forever like to roll out, where they would have like a dedicated secure communications network where people could like communicate and like also connect with each other and in smaller groups and things like that. But like, can like try thinking of the government doing that.
And then try thinking of your representatives figuring out how to sign on to that. Like, think of Dianne Feinstein having to open a computer and like sign into it.
Yeah. Some of the people who were working on this after 9/11 recently got together, like a group of like congressional expats, to just try and like run a congressional session on Zoom. And it was apparently, they reported back after they did it, and it was like a complete disaster. It was an abject
failure. It feels like, though, it should be really easy because Congress operates according to these really stodgy decorum rules. And so you're never in a situation where more than one person is speaking out at a time or anything.
Yeah.
The way that they operate during their public-facing meetings is incredibly long-winded and boring, but also it would work perfectly on Zoom. I think it's harder to be in a productive group discussion on Zoom.
I think so too. Well, and those rules that you mentioned are sort of also like another sticking point, because both of those chambers take all of their rules like very seriously to a point where it's just sort of like, oh God. But like, it sort of like brings up questions of like, you know, so many of their rules are like based on all of them being in a room together, you know? Yeah. I mean, like there's rules based on and if you start doing this digitally where people are home, like what is considered present? What is considered having a quorum? There's so many like core principles of just like the functionality of those chambers that sort of like exist based on people needing to be in a room together, that it's sort of like just their base rules would have to be revisited, which is another thing you sort of like can't really imagine all of them doing. No. And they take those rules very seriously to the point where like there have been some very dramatic moments over the years in Congress that were like based specifically on whether someone was there or not. Like, I don't remember this, but Bob Packwood in 1988 was carried into the Senate chamber feet first just so they could ensure a quorum so they could move on with something.
But
and
also
you will probably remember that in like 20 years later when they were trying to pass Obamacare, Ted Kennedy came back to the Senate like with a brain tumor just to be able to vote on that. So like they take being in the room very
seriously. But they also don't have any constitutional definition of what a quorum is. No, so they don't. Make up what a quorum is.
And
every
Mitch
time.
McConnell will change the rules to his own, you know.
He doesn't care about what the Constitution says.
Right.
But I mean, they can redefine quorum to mean anything they want because it's not well defined in the Constitution.
Yeah.
So
yeah. There's also just like some concerns about like what it would like look like. Even if they were able to figure it all out, there's like concerns that if everyone was working from home, the people who did stay, which presumably would be the leadership, would sort of like end up sort of like being like a de facto kind of like ruling, you know, cadre.
Cabal.
Because you would sort of like have everyone at home. And then if you had sort of like only the leadership people there, they're sort of like not having to deal with like the complexities and like, you know, general messiness of like having to deal with their own members. So it would sort of you could see a world where they sort of like are ultimately able to usurp the power from sort of like the masses and sort of like have it concentrated amongst themselves. So that's a problem. And then conversely, like leadership sort of would be concerned that basically everybody working from home, they would probably just be in constant dereliction of their job. I mean, we know how working from home can be. They would just be nonstop campaigning. They would be nonstop fundraising. They would just sort of like, would they actually be focused on their job?
Yeah. And it would change the way that government functions in a lot of ways, because so much of it is focused on like glad handing in rooms.
Totally.
I mean, just everything about the way Washington works is very old-fashioned in the sense that that's why someone like Joe Biden, who's bringing no meaningful ideas to the table, is still someone that's acceptable to people there. Because they're just like, well, we just need to be wanted. It's as long as he's someone that we'd be willing to be in a room with.
Right, exactly.
That's what matters. It doesn't really matter if he's good ideas.
Enough people on the back over the years that.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of prioritizing that. Yeah. In the same way that, like, I mean, you hear this in a lot of industries, like, you hear this about how writers' rooms are staffed in Hollywood, where they're just, like, the most important thing is that you want to be, that you're willing to sit in a room with someone all day. It doesn't even matter if they're a good writer. It's a bonus if they're a good writer, but you'd rather spend your day with someone that's fun to be around than spend your day with someone talented who's horrible to be around. Like, that's how a lot of, how a lot of industries function, for better or worse.
Anyway, the moral of the story is, if you were wondering whether Congress is going to be working from home anytime soon.
The answer is no.
It seems like probably not.
Well, they might be not working from home because they seem to be intent on going home and not working. Right. So,
and then panicking about having to come back.
Right, exactly. It does feel like in this moment, even though I know that we are social distancing and so they should be coming up with a way that Congress can meet and be socially distant, they should be required to be in Washington right now.
Well, that's the other thing, too. I mean, like, I did sort of, you know, for the reasons that we stated, everybody's old and, like, you know, whatever, and people are testing positive there. But, I mean, you know, the LA City Council has canceled their next couple meetings, and they are getting massive shit for it. And like, I agree with you. I mean, now is the time where we need governance. Leadership. We need governance. We need government. I mean, just the fact that everything in this, you know, everything that we are seeing sort of happen right now is just sort of proof that a strong central government in times of crisis slash all the time is really what is best suited to serve the people and to be good for the people and the country at large. So I agree. I think that like if the people at the Gelsons up the street are being forced to work right now, then my two senators and congressperson should not be trying to figure out how to work from home.
No, and also, if they want to work from home, fine, but they should be at home in D.C., not at home in their district, because they should be required to show up if they're needed.
Totally.
They should not be in a situation where it's unsafe for them to show up because they left town.
Right.
Because right now, I mean, A, should they be traveling right now? No.
Well, no.
So, like, already, no. But there is not something that they are needed for in their district. There is something that they are needed for in Washington. We don't need Adam Schiff right now to be around hanging out. We need him to be doing his job representing us in Washington. And so, because we're in a crisis. So I don't want these members to go back to their districts, because their districts can certainly continue. They continue to have staff here. They can continue to hear from people in their district, but they're needed right now in Washington. Like,
exactly.
And even if that neededness is just, you know, just in case, even if that is just because they might be needed, they should not be unavailable when the moment comes.
Like, right.
Anyway. Meanwhile, we finally invoked the Defense Production Act. I think Trump thinks that that's going to like immediately turn things around. And instead, that's going to take like months to have any meaningful impact. Right. And we should have done it months ago. But
people had been pressuring him to do it.
Right.
And he was kept saying that he didn't need to. And that he would be happy to do it, but everybody was just doing it already. Like everybody was just sort of like,
everyone just does the right thing all the time.
He didn't need to use this to like force them to do it. But as it turns out, they weren't doing it.
Surprise.
Surprise.
It turns out that giant corporations whose incentive is to make money don't just like immediately switch all of their manufacturing power to do something in the public interest just because.
I know.
Is that what you're telling me, Brent?
That is exactly what I am telling you.
I am shocked. I am shocked and appalled.
I know. But anyway, this all sort of like happened on Twitter, obviously.
Where policy is made.
That's what happens. But apparently Trump had a deal with GM where they were going to like make a certain amount of ventilators. But then they apparently like told him that they weren't going to be able to make a certain amount of ventilators. So Trump took to Twitter. Yeah. And he said, as usual with this General Motors, things just never seem to work out.
General Motors.
I know. They said they were going to give us 40,000 much-needed ventilators very quickly. Now they're saying it will be 6,000 in late April, and they want top dollar. Always a mess with Mary B. Invoke P. What?
Now, if you're wondering what invoke P means.
Right. Mary B. is Mary Barra.
Mary Barra.
Mary Barra, excuse me, yes. No. Who's the CEO of GM. So that's what that is, which even that sort of like was worded weirdly enough that it was like, wait, what? But invoke P, everybody was sort of like, what does that mean?
Right, and what so is P?
Later, Trump was asked about it and he was like, oh, it means invoke the Defense Production Act. And
that's like, not what, no, it
does,
doesn't.
It does?
That's the invoke letter P does not stand in for the Defense Production. No one, at
first
no
off,
time,
everybody calls it the DPA. People have been calling it the DPA for weeks as they pester him to invoke it.
No one's ever called it the P because that's not what it's called. Also, you can't make up an acronym that is not a well-understood term for something and then decide you're going
to
use it.
You can't just assign one letter to something.
No, that's not. Like, first of all, there's a reason that acronyms aren't just one letter, and it's because there's only 26 letters and there's like a million acronyms. I'm already having an issue because I have a friend who works at Google, and it was telling me something about something, some email that someone sent her where they referred to themselves as a POC, meaning point of contact. Now, I see POC and I think of person of color.
Of course.
But then also I saw a POC listed on Twitter the other day, and it was point of care, which was a healthcare term. And I was just like, we can't everyone needs a different acronym for everything. Because every time I read one of these things, I was like, why would we need people of color for to be funded for healthcare? Like, it was like something where, like, the wording, yeah. I was like, this doesn't make any sense. We need more people of color for something. They meant more points of care, which we do, for getting the coronavirus test. And it was worded as if we needed more people of color for getting the coronavirus test. And I was like, anyone can give you the coronavirus test. It was just so confusing. But right. I feel like we're in a situation like this with him, where the DPA... Already, probably there's a company somewhere that uses that as a jargony term to mean, you know, like down putting actions, or, you know, something where it's like a, right. you know, some dumb acronym that like Microsoft yeah. uses or something like that. Like, we can't, there is no such thing as shortening it even further.
No. And also, besides the fact that it was just like generally confusing because nobody knew what it meant, people sort of like imagined that maybe that's what it meant. But at the time of the tweet, he hadn't actually invoked the DPA, so everyone was like confused about that too. Like, even if you could decide that he meant what he meant, everybody was like, oh, does this mean he's actually doing it now? But then later he clarified, because he sent another mostly caps tweet with like 74 exclamation points in it, where he said
some weird capitalizations as well.
Right. He said General Motors must immediately open their stupidly abandoned Lordstown plant in Ohio,
oddly,
or some other plant or another one. Or some other plant, and start making ventilators now. That was in all caps with like 7 exclamation points. He said, Ford, get going on ventilators, fast. And then he tagged General Motors and Ford.
So he notified them on Twitter that they should be making ventilators?
That's right.
In their Lordstown plant in Ohio, or some other plant. Any plant's fine. He's suggesting Lordstown.
Yeah, sure. Well, because that one was stupidly abandoned.
Right, that's true.
Specifically.
Yeah. The stupidly abandoned Lordstown plant in Ohio is really... the most important thing to take away from this. The reason that we're in a panic about ventilators is because we are leading the world in coronavirus cases. Pulled ahead this week and not looking back.
Oh yeah, it's not even close now. We've pulled ahead and...
We pulled ahead by an amount that...
We will not be caught.
We refuse. Yeah, we're at 136, almost 137,000 cases.
Yeah, we're almost at 1/5 of the world's cases.
Yeah, and we are also at, like, basically... At almost twice what the next biggest amount is. I think China had 80,000 cases or 82 or something.
Potentially. I think Italy's ahead of China now.
Oh, Italy's back in the lead.
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
These rankings are moving fast, you guys. You got to keep up. Every day it's a new rankings. Yeah. But we're steadily in the lead, and I believe we are going to stay there because we are doing almost nothing to address the crisis in any meaningful respect. So... we are now 1/5 of the world's coronavirus cases. Surprise, mm-hmm. surprise. It turns out that having a single-payer system isn't worse than not having a single-payer system, as Joe Biden erroneously declared.
Right.
And some exciting new reports on who does and doesn't have coronavirus are emerging, too, because Boris Johnson has coronavirus. What is happening, you guys? And Prince Albert II... coronavirus.
Yes.
The head of he's the head of state of Monaco. Prince yep. Charles has coronavirus, but you know who doesn't have coronavirus is Katie Porter. That is a relief to all of us. The last thing we needed is Katie Porter to get coronavirus.
Oh my god, I know.
And Trump is going to release the new federal guidelines that we were talking about earlier in the podcast this week, and they'll probably be terrible because they'll probably be sort of mushily worded.
Oh yeah.
Because. He's still planning to ease the social distancing guidelines too early. He's just abandoned.
Although he did, you know, I will say that in that in his press conference today, he did. Well, they are moving it to April 30th now, so he's like given up on the sort of like churches full of people on Easter, and he also said he was like could be earlier, could be later. And he also, like, got asked
could
whether...
Could be whatever I feel like it.
Right. And he also got asked whether he was going to, like, release those guidelines for places that, like, could be, like, sort of, like, less of an issue. And he was like, well, I'm getting told by these two that that's not a great idea. And pointed to Dr. Fauci and the other doctor.
I can't believe Fauci still got a job.
Me. Right?
I mean, that's a real situation. I mean, situation for us, but...
So,
curious situation.
I will be perfectly honest. Today was, and he still was like railing at the guy from CNN asking him a question for being fake news and talking about the only reason that they're showing his press conferences because he gets good ratings and otherwise they wouldn't. And they are.
Oh, yeah, he was into ratings today.
They're terrible people and everything else.
He tweeted a lot about his
some of the things that he said, just in terms of like what they are doing and plan to be doing, I feel like was the closest that he's been to the right answer so far.
Right.
He might be the furthest away to the right answer as of his press conference tomorrow. That's the problem with him, is that he's on every side of every issue. Yesterday, there were rumors that he was going to like actually quarantine New York, and then he decided that that wasn't a great idea. He's thrown out a million different things that he has decided later either are good ideas, or he has said that things weren't good ideas that he's decided later were good ideas. He doesn't know what he thinks about anything. But today was the closest, which I say, you know, knowing that close for him is yet so far.
I feel like he remains pretty far from some of the facts.
For sure.
Because he also said that we've tested the most people per capita of any country.
Well, he keeps talking about how we've tested more people, which is true. Yes.
Right. But that's, we have more people too.
But we have more people. That's exactly right. Like both South Korea and Italy have tested more than three times the amount of people that we have. So per capita, we're not doing it, which is the huge problem. Like, because even Dr. Fauci sort of surprised people, I think, when he agreed that there would be a way for the president to ease some restrictions for specific places. But the only way to be able to do that is if you've basically like tested the entire place.
Yeah.
So like if you test all of Nebraska and tell people in Nebraska to, you know, maybe don't go to Iowa or Colorado or whatever, like then you could say, okay, well, like Nebraska can go back to work, but you can't if you haven't tested everybody. And that is sort of like where we're like clearly lagging behind, regardless of what Trump says. Like you can't ease these restrictions without massive testing.
Right, because what your goal is assuming, you know, coronavirus is not going to be extinguished. What your goal is to get back to the point where you can do what you should have done in the first place, which is contact tracing and quarantining the people that are affected.
That's it.
And then you have to devote the resources to making sure that you contact and you do contact tracing and test all of those people and quarantine anyone who's positive proactively, instead of waiting until everyone has it so much that we just, none of us can leave our homes.
Right. And you also can't do that while you're lagging behind on testing.
No, exactly. And you also have to, the reason that the testing is so important also is that it is the states that drive our economy are huge states with large populations. And so you need to be able to test not just everyone in Nebraska, where it's not super relevant to the entire nation's financial health if Nebraska goes back to work.
Right.
But it's really important that California and New York can go back to work. So it's not that it's not important to the people of Nebraska that they deserve tests just like everyone.
Right, they're people too.
There are people too. But it is important that he's not going to be able to just like play games where he only gives testing to red states and think that that's going to bring the economy back. Because if he continues to allow New York and California to lag behind, then we are going to continue to have a problem.
Yeah.
But the good news is he's getting great ratings.
Right. He compared his ratings to both The Bachelor and Monday Night Football in this press conference.
So that's good news. So we know what he's been spending his time doing. He tweeted about it too. So that's what's really important here. People are dying, whatever.
Right.
Is Donald Trump getting great ratings, though? I think we can agree that his ratings are top-notch. And that's how you know you have a successful president on your hands.
Right.
So things are in some ways not changing at all, as they change rapidly.
Right. Yeah. Oh, man.
Well, guys, that's the news this week. We've been really carefully monitoring the L.A. City or L.A. County coronavirus numbers daily.
That's one of my favorite things to do.
Yesterday we spent...
And then react like a crazy person too. Also.
Obviously. Yesterday we spent like an hour looking for charts of the growth of the virus in other places so that we can find out where on their chart LA is to see how many days behind or ahead of them we are.
Yeah.
Our curve is so far flatter than New York's, but we might be doing less testing. We don't know. We did notice that we were at about March 19th in New York time. And it is... you know, March 29th here. So we're about 10 days behind them, according to our current testing regimen.
We've been averaging like 300 new cases for like the last 4 days, give or take a little bit. There was a weird spike on Thursday, which is when I had a crazy person reaction.
And that's why he went to the grocery store.
But also, I was really more that I was afraid that everybody else was going to do that.
Right. He was worried about food hoarding coming back.
Right. It didn't.
It didn't. I'm glad because I have to go to the grocery store this week for the first time, and I am nervous, I will tell you.
Well, once you get inside, if you can deal with the panic of being in a grocery store while this is happening, it's going to be one of the best grocery store experiences that you've ever had. Because there's nobody. There's like 10 people in there. I mean, you literally just, I mean, you could do a song and dance number in there if you wanted to. I mean, no one would interrupt you.
For that experience. I'm going to wear a mask even though we're being shamed for doing that because...
You know what?
Listen, you guys...
If you have I wore a mask. I mean, it was a surgical mask, so it's like probably didn't do anything. But I mean, like, it was fine. I also wore rubber gloves. I wiped all of my groceries down as soon as I got them in the house, like a lunatic. But like,
I mean, you got to do what you got to do.
This is what we're doing.
And also, even if this is psychosomatic, I mean, I'm taking my temperature twice a day. So I...
For
psychosomatic
sure.
stuff works.
Yeah.
Sorry about
my
it.
My thermometer is sitting on my coffee table over there that I just... grab when I'm bored.
Right. Sometimes you want to know what your temperature is. Sometimes that's six times a day. Sometimes it's only two. You don't know. You don't know when the urge to take your temperature will strike. But pandemic times, that's one of the activities that you get up to.
That's right.
But so it does seem like, according to the current numbers, we are on a flatter curve than New York, which is good news.
But they also, everybody in the city keeps telling us that it's like going to be the end of April, that like it's going to be like our peak, which you and I tried to figure out the other day, and
we'll spare you
from trying to figure it out again in front of you because it also might be embarrassing for us. I don't know.
Well, that's one thing I will say.
We don't do math, is the problem.
We started social distancing by law one day before New York. And if we are 10 days behind New York,
and it was being suggested prior to that.
Right. So if we are 10 days behind New York and our official policy kicked in the day before theirs, then that was smart of us to do. I don't know if it's going to, we're still going to have coronavirus, obviously.
Of course.
But that was,
cases, I think, just in the county. So
I'm glad, though, that we are, that we started when we did.
Right. Stop going to the farmer's market, by the way. I can guarantee you that that's going to be closed because Eric Garcetti has been.
He's not afraid to close.
He's had zero fucks.
Yeah. He closed Runyon. He closed
Runyon because, like,
everyone was
tweet
there.
A picture of more than two people in a location, Eric Garcetti will shut it down for you.
That's right. So if you have a secret location where you're gathering with hundreds of people, do not put that shit on Twitter.
No.
That's some advice from us to
Eric
you.
Garcetti
but also,
will
don't
come for
go
you.
There. Don't
yeah.
go there.
Well,
so,
yeah, right. Exactly.
Right,
don't
do
that.
Right. But yeah. So we will be back next week.
Yeah.
With more excitement.
Yeah.
And boredom, because we are stuck in our home still. So.
Yeah.
But that's the news this week. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye.